Seller dominated sales around the world for most of the 20th century, and it remains part of the modern landscape, with sales organizations devising elaborate processes and audience-tested phrases to guide its players toward the final curtain. Scripts perform nicely in stable and predictable environments, when buyers have minimal choices and sellers have maximal information. But those circumstances, as we've seen, have become rarer. A memorized book of arguments is less valuable when the company already provides a list of frequently asked questions on its website, and when, in any event, customers can discover the ground truth from their social networks. Here, theater offers some instructions on what comes next. For hundreds of years, except for the occasional clown or mime, most stage performances relied on actors reciting memorized lines written by someone else. Indeed, until 1968, the Lord Chamberlain's office in the United Kingdom had to read and approve every play before it could be performed in the UK, and sent monitors to watch the plays to ensure performers were sticking to the approved text. But about 50 years ago, two innovators began to challenge the single-minded reliance on scripts. The first was Viola Spolin, an American who in the 1940s and 50s developed a set of games, first for children, then for professional actors, centered around improvising characters, speeches, and scenes. In 1963, she wrote a book, Improvisation for the Theater, that encapsulated these exercises and quickly became a mainstay of theater programs. Thanks to her son Paul Sills, who took up the family trade, her ideas eventually gave rise to the now legendary Second City Troupe, whose alumni, from John Belushi to Stephen Colbert to Tina Fey, have shaped American popular entertainment with their mastery of off-script, real-time comedic performance. The second innovator was Keith Johnstone, a Brit who worked for years at London's Royal Court Theatre. As he grew weary of conventional theatre, he too began devising his own set of looser, less traditional performance techniques. And in 1979, he wrote what many considered the seminal work in the field, Impro, Improvisation in the Theatre. The founders of Palantir, a company I mentioned in Chapter 2, ask all employees to read Impro before starting their jobs. By encouraging directors and performers to recognize the virtues of breaking with the script, Spolin and Johnstone help make improv a mainstream form of entertainment. Sales and non-sales selling is developing along a similar path, because the stable, simple, and certain conditions that favored scripts have now given way to the dynamic, complex, and unpredictable conditions that favor improvisation. Beneath the apparent chaos of improvisation is a light structure that allows it to work. Understanding that structure can help you move others, especially when your astute perspective taking, infectious positivity, and brilliant framing don't deliver the results you seek. In those circumstances and many others, you'll do better if you follow three essential rules of improvisational theater. 1, hear offers. 2, say yes and. 3, make your partner look good. 1. Hear offers. Theatrical improvisation is not a complete alien on the planet of business. Scholars such as Keith Sawyer at Washington University, Mary Crossan at the University of Western Ontario, and Patricia Ryan Madsen, who taught at Stanford University, have studied its dimensions and applied its concepts to management, innovation, and design. But most experts haven't looked at improv in the realm of sales, even though, as one young scholar says, salespeople adept at improvising can generate ideas, incorporate changes quickly and easily, and communicate effectively and convincingly during sales presentations. One reason for the oversight might be a legacy of 100-plus years of sales training. Since the days of NCR's carefully plotted scripts, salespeople have been taught to, quote, overcome objections. If the customer doesn't want to buy, your job is to turn her around, to convince her that the problems she's raising either don't exist or don't matter. Overcoming objections is a stage in every formal sales process, one that usually follows prospecting for leads, qualifying leads, and making the presentation, and that stands just before closing. But now that sales has changed dramatically, the very idea of turning people around might be less valuable and perhaps less possible than it's ever been. Improvisational theater has no room for overcoming objections because it's built on a diametrically opposite principle. The bread and butter of improv, says Sallet, is hearing offers. The first principle of improvisation, hearing offers, hinges on attunement, leaving our own perspective to inhabit the perspective of another. And to master this aspect of improvisation, we must rethink our understanding of what it is to listen and what constitutes an offer. For all the listening we do each day, by some estimates it occupies 1/4 of our waking hours, it's remarkable how profoundly we neglect this skill. As the American philosopher Mortimer Adler wrote 30 years ago, "Is anyone anywhere taught how to listen? How utterly amazing is the general assumption that the ability to listen well is a natural gift for which no training is required. How extraordinary is the fact that no effort is made anywhere in the whole educational process to help individuals learn how to listen well." Little wonder, then, that so few of us, in fact, do listen well. For many of us, the opposite of talking isn't listening. It's waiting. When others speak, we typically divide our attention between what they're saying now and what we're going to say next, and end up doing a mediocre job at both. And a few professionals, including those who are in the business of moving others, don't even bother to wait. In one typical study, researchers found that physicians interrupt the majority of patients in the first 18 seconds the patient speaks during an appointment, which often prevents the patient from describing what brought her to the office in the first place. That's why Sallet's training emphasizes slowing down and shutting up as the route to listening well. We learn this in another exercise called Amazing Silence, where I'm paired with a top television executive about 10 years my senior. The rules? One person has to reveal to the other something important to him. The other person, who must make eye contact the entire time, then responds, but he must wait 15 seconds before uttering a word. The executive opens his heart more than I expect. He tells me that after 32 years of demanding work, he's questioning whether what he's doing now is what he should be doing forever, and whether it's time to leave the jackal-eat-jackal savanna of New York media. His eyes water a bit as he speaks, which makes me even more uncomfortable than I was doing the vertical bebop with the high-heeled cosmetics vice president. When he's finished, I have to respond. But not yet. I begin counting down the seconds in my head. 15. 14. 13. No breaking eye contact. 12. 11. This is agonizing. 10. When will the madness end? It does end. But those 15 seconds feel preposterously long and, as in the earlier exercise, disturbingly intimate. And that's what Sallet wants. Listening without some degree of intimacy isn't really listening. It's passive and transactional rather than active and engaged. Genuine listening is a bit like driving on a rain-slicked highway. Speed kills. If you want to get to your destination, you're better off decelerating and occasionally hitting the brake. The ultimate idea, she says, uncorking a small bottle of Zen in the cramped conference room when the session is over, is to, quote, listen without listening for anything. This is what makes improvisational theater work. Imagine a scene with two actors. The first, sitting in a chair, his hands perched on an invisible steering wheel, says to his partner, "Be sure to lock the door." The second actor hasn't been listening for anything. She's just been listening. Her job in that situation, Sallet tells us, is to take in anything and everything someone says as an offer you can do something with. The invisible steering wheel and the directive, "Be sure to lock the door," constitute an offer. The second actor must accept it and build on it. Maybe she's a passenger in a taxi. Maybe she's a kid in a back seat of the family car. Maybe she has a broken arm and can't reach the lock. But her ability to listen without listening for is what allows the scene to move forward. Once we listen in this new, more intimate way, we begin hearing things we might have missed. And if we listen this way during our efforts to move others, we quickly realize that what seem outwardly like objections are often offers in disguise. Take a simple example. Suppose you're raising money for a charity and you ask your brother-in-law to contribute $200. He might say no, but he's unlikely to say only that. He's more likely to say, sorry, I can't give $200. That's an offer. Maybe he can donate a smaller amount. Or he might say, no, I can't give right now. That's an offer too. The obvious move is to fasten onto the right now and ask him when might be a better time. But the entire sentence is an offer. Perhaps to contribute to your charity some other way, say as a volunteer. Offers come in all shapes and sizes, says Salad, but the only way to hear them is to change the way you listen and then change the way you respond. Which goes back to my mirroring exercise with the cosmetics executive. What each of us was doing in that session was accepting an offer. We didn't have the option of objecting. No way, lady, I'm not doing that with my elbow. And once we accepted those rules, we fell into an odd but attuned ballet. Eventually, when the bell rang for us to switch roles again, our actions were so smooth that an outsider probably couldn't tell who was leading and who was following. That's the point of the first principle of improvisation. As Johnstone puts it, good improvisers seem telepathic. Everything looks prearranged. This is because they accept all offers made. 2. Say yes and. The ocean of rejection that we face every day in sales and non-sales selling delivers plenty of no's to our shores. But we also send many back out with the tide, saying no ourselves more often than we realize. Improvisational theater urges actors to check this behavior and say yes and instead. Like a potter learning to center the clay on the wheel, or a tennis player acquiring the proper grip, saying yes and is a foundational skill for improv artists. This second principle of improvisation depends on buoyancy, in particular the quality of positivity. But positivity in this regard is more than avoiding no, and it's more than simply saying yes. Yes and carries a particular force, which becomes clearer when we contrast it with its evil twin, yes but. Nearly every improv class includes a version on the following exercise. We didn't do this in Salad sessions, but she showed it to me when she visited my office a few months later. The exercise involves two people who are planning a hypothetical gathering, say a high school reunion. One person begins with a proposition. For example, let's have our high school reunion in Las Vegas. Every subsequent comment from both participants must begin with yes, but. It usually unfolds something like this. Let's have our high school reunion in Las Vegas. Yes, but that's going to be too expensive for some people. Yes, but that way only the people who really want to be there will attend. Yes, but some of our classmates don't gamble. Yes, but there's more to do there than play blackjack. Yes, but even without gambling, it's still not a great place for people to bring their families. Yes, but reunions are better without all those kids. Yes, but if people can't find childcare at home, they won't attend. The planning process spins and spins, but nothing and nobody moves. Then participants take an alternative route, where the undermining conjunction but is replaced with its more inclusive sibling and. This version might go like this. Let's have our high school reunion in Las Vegas. Yes. And if it's too expensive for some people, we can raise money or organize road trips. Yes. And if we start early, we could reserve a block of rooms at a hotel that offers volume discounts. Yes. And for the families with kids or for people who don't gamble, we could organize activities during the day. Yes. And if we have enough people, we might be able to pool our resources to pay for babysitters so one night some parents can go out on their own. Yes, and those who wanted to could all go to a show together. Instead of swirling downward into frustration, yes and spirals upward into possibility. When you stop, you've got a set of options, not a sense of futility. There are plenty of times in life to say no. When it comes to moving others, however, the best default position is this second principle of improv, and its benefits stretch further than sales and non-sales selling. Yes, and isn't a technique, Salat says. It's a way of life. 3. Make your partner look good. In the summer of 2012, two giants in the field of moving others passed away. Roger Fisher, who died in August of that year, shortly after reaching his 90th birthday, was a Harvard Law School professor and freelance diplomatic troubleshooter. In 1981, he co-authored Getting to Yes, the most influential book ever written about negotiation. Fisher's signal contribution was the concept of principled negotiation, which proposed that the aim of negotiating shouldn't be to make the other side lose, but where possible, to help it win. This idea, which quickly became shorthanded as win-win, transformed business and legal education. Until then, many viewed negotiation as a zero-sum game, where parties vied for the largest share of a fixed pie. But Fisher's work urged young business students and law students, and less young people inside organizations, to reframe these encounters as positive-sum games, where one person's victory didn't depend on another's defeat. By looking past the other party's position to its actual interests, and by inventing options for mutual gain, negotiations could end with both sides better off than when they began. The second giant, who died just 6 weeks before Fisher at the age of 79, took the core of Fisher's idea to an even larger audience. In 1989, Stephen R. Covey wrote The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, which went on to sell more than 25 million copies. Habit 4 on Covey's list is think, win, win. Establishing this habit isn't easy, he acknowledged, because most people have been deeply scripted in the win-lose mentality since birth. But the only way to truly influence others is to adopt a frame of mind and heart that constantly seeks mutual benefit in all human interactions. Because of Fisher and Covey's influence, win-win has become a fixture in organizations around the world, though often more in parlance than in practice. One explanation for the disconnect between word and deed goes back to the upheaval I described in Chapter 3. Under conditions of information asymmetry, results frequently are win-lose. After all, when I know more than you, I can get what I want by beating you. And since information asymmetry was the defining condition of sales for so long, our muscle memory often takes us in that direction. But with the emergence of information parity, or at least something close to it, those instincts, developed for a different environment, can send us down the wrong path. When sellers and buyers are evenly matched, pushing for win-lose rarely leads to a win for anyone, and often ends in lose-lose. Improv offers a way to freshen our thinking, a method that shares the worldview of Fisher and Covey, but reorients it for a time when many of us have become desensitized to win-win from hearing it so regularly, but experiencing it so rarely. In Kathy Salat and Second City's brand of theater, performers must follow this rule: make your partner look good. Improv artists have long understood that helping your fellow performer shine helps you both create a better scene. Making your partner look good doesn't make you look worse, it actually makes you look better. It shatters the binary either-or zero-sum frame of mind and replaces it with a culture of generosity, creativity, and possibility. This third principle of improv, make your partner look good, calls for and enables clarity, the capacity to develop solutions that nobody previously imagined. To illustrate this principle, Salat tells us to find new partners. Mine is a friendly 40-something woman who works for a large financial services company. For this exercise, called I'm Curious, we choose a controversial issue that lends itself to opposing pro-con positions. Should marijuana be legal? Should the death penalty be abolished? Then, we each choose a side, with one person trying to convince the other of his or her point of view. The other person must respond, but here's the wrinkle, only with questions. The questions must be genuine queries, not veiled opinions. Does it trouble you that the only people who share your view are imbeciles? They can't be yes-no questions either. I'm right, aren't I? If a partner violates any of the rules by making a statement or asking a prohibited type of question, we're to ring the motel bell to announce the violation to the whole group. I begin in the role of questioner, and my partner stakes out a position on a long-forgotten American political controversy that happened to be front-page news the day of our seminar. I respond to her first claim with an arch, "Really?" Which is technically a question, but not one exactly true to the spirit of the exercise. So I gather myself and ask a real question. She answers and expands her argument. Trying to remember the importance of slowing down, I pause, take a breath, and begin my question with, "But what about a little better?" Then she moves to another line of reasoning. Without waiting, without even realizing what I'm saying, I gasp, "You've got to be kidding." Ding! 4 minutes into the game, I've ended up in the penalty box. Now it's her turn in the questioner role. Maybe because she's seen how poorly I did, she performs more nimbly. When I set out an argument, her first response every single time is, "That's so interesting." The maneuver gives her time to conjure a question, but it also spins the weather vane in a friendlier direction. And when she poses a question, I have to stop a moment, think, and offer an intelligent answer. The idea here isn't to win, it's to learn. And when both parties view their encounters as opportunities to learn, the desire to defeat the other side struggles to find the oxygen it needs. Questions, whose potency we've seen in both interrogative self-talk and in pitching effectively, change the rules of engagement and therefore the nature of the interaction itself. The conversation becomes more of a dance and less of a wrestling match. That's something that Fuller Brush founder Alfred Fuller intuited years before improv was ever invented. "Never argue," he wrote. "To win an argument is to lose a sale." Making your partner, the person you're selling to, look good has become even more critical than it was in Fuller's day. Back then, unscrupulous sellers didn't have to worry so much about making buyers look bad. Buyers often had nowhere else to go and nobody to tell. Today, if you make people look bad, they can tell the world. But if you make people look good, they can also tell the world. In improv, you never try to get someone to do something. That's coercion, not creativity, Salad says. You make offers, you accept offers, and a conversation, a relationship, a scene, and other possibilities emerge. As goes improv, so goes sales and non-sales selling. If you train your ears to hear offers, if you respond to others with yes and if you always try to make your counterpart look good, possibilities will emerge. Here's the sample case for Chapter 8, Improvise. First, take 5. 18 centuries ago, the Greek Stoic philosopher Epictetus said, "Nature hath given men one tongue, but 2 ears, that we may hear from others twice as much as we speak." Unfortunately, not many people listen to him. You can avoid their mistake by taking Epictetus's counsel seriously. One of the simplest ways to do that, to reduce your ratio of talking to listening, is simply to slow down. Designate one day this week to be your slow day. Then, when you have a conversation, take 5 seconds before responding. Seriously, every time. It will seem odd at first, and your conversation partner might wonder if you were recently bonked on the head. But pausing a few additional seconds to respond can hone your listening skills in much the same way that savoring a piece of chocolate instead of wolfing it down can improve your palate. If a whole day is too much, start smaller. Try it for an hour. Lori Hennigan, a British consultant who advocates what she calls radical listening, offers some ways to test whether you've slowed down enough. Are your conversation partners actually finishing their sentences? Are people getting their perspective fully on the table without your interrupting? Do they have time to take a breath before you start yapping? Taking it slower can take you further. Second, say yes and. One classic improv exercise is the ad game. Here's how it works. Select 4 or 5 participants, then ask them to invent a new product and devise an advertising campaign for it. As players contribute testimonials or demonstrations or slogans, they must begin each sentence with, "Yes and," which forces them to build on the previous idea. You can't refute what your colleagues say, you can't ignore it, and you shouldn't plan ahead. Just say yes and, accept what the person before you offers, and use it to construct an even better campaign. There are people who prefer to say yes, and there are people who prefer to say no, Keith Johnstone writes. Those who say yes are rewarded by the adventures they have. Those who say no are rewarded by the safety they attain. Third, play word at a time. This is another classic improv game that has spawned lots of variations, though I like Johnstone's version best. The rules are simple. 6 to 8 people sit in a circle and collectively craft a story. The hitch? Each person can add only one word, and only when it's his turn. In his book, Impro for Storytellers, Johnson describes one session with 2 partners helping him create. He began with the word Sally, and what followed was this. Sally was going. It's my turn again, and I stir things up. Mad because her father wanted to put his horse into her stable. Johnson says, some of these stories fizzle out after one sentence, but some may complete themselves. However the tales unfold, this exercise is great for helping you think quickly and tune your ears to offers. Fourth, enlist the power of questions. One of the salad session exercises I enjoyed the most, I'm curious, is worth replicating on your own. Find a partner. Then choose a controversial issue that has 2 distinct and opposed sides. Before you begin, have your partner decide her position on the issue. Then you take the opposite stance. She then makes her case, but you can reply only with questions, not with statements, counterarguments, or insults. These questions must also abide by 3 rules. 1, you cannot ask yes-no questions. 2, the questions cannot be veiled opinions. 3, your partner must answer each question. This is tougher than it sounds, but with practice, you'll learn to use the interrogative to elevate and engage both your partner and yourself. 5th, read these books. Impro, Improvisation and Theater by Keith Johnstone. If improvisational theater has a Lenin, a well-spoken revolutionary who provides a movement its intellectual underpinnings, that person is Johnstone. His book isn't always easy reading. It's as much a philosophical tract as the guidebook it purports to be. But it's an excellent primer for grasping the underlying principles of improvisation. Improvisation for Theater by Viola Spolin. If improvisational theater has an Eve, someone who is present at the creation, though in this case didn't need an Adam and didn't fall to temptation, it's Viola Spolin. This book, which came out 50 years ago, but whose updated edition remains a brisk seller, collects more than 200 of Spolin's improv exercises. Creating Conversations, Improvisation in Everyday Discourse by R. Keith Sawyer. Sawyer is a leading scholar of creativity. In this 2001 book, he zeroes in on our everyday conversations and shows how much these quotidian exchanges have in common with jazz, children's play, and improvisational theater. Also worth looking at is Sawyer's Group Genius, The Creative Power of Collaboration. Improv Wisdom, Don't Prepare, Just Show Up by Patricia Ryan Madsen. Madsen, who taught drama at Stanford University until 2005, serves up 13 maxims drawn from improv that readers can apply to their work and life. The Second City Almanac of Improvisation by Anne Libera. One part entertainment history, another part improv guidebook, this almanac charts the rise of the Second City improv juggernaut. It's sprinkled with interesting exercises, provocative quotations on the craft, and lots of photos of well-known comedians when they were very young. 6th, Use your thumbs. This is a group activity that you can use to make a memorable point. Along with yourself, you'll need at least two more people as participants. Have everyone assemble themselves into pairs. Then ask each pair to hook the fingers of your right hands and raise your thumbs. Then give the sole instruction. Now get your partner's thumb down. Remain silent and allow the pairs to finish the task. Most participants will assume that your instructions mean for them to thumb wrestle. However, there are many other ways that they could get their partner's thumb down. They could ask nicely. They could unhook their own fingers and put their own thumb down, and so on. The lesson here is that too often our starting point is competition, a win-lose, zero-sum approach, rather than the win-win, positive-sum approach of improvisation. In most circumstances that involve moving others, we have several ways to accomplish a task, most of which can make our partners look good in the process. Chapter 9. Serve. If you want to travel from one town to another in Kenya, you'll probably have to step into a matatu, a small bus or 14-seat minivan that constitutes the country's main form of long-distance transportation. And if you do board one, prepare to be terrified. A young male behind the wheel of a fast-moving vehicle can be perilous in any country, but Kenyans say matatu drivers are especially unhinged. Like something out of the strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, otherwise kind and even-tempered Kenyan men become wild-eyed, speed-limit-crushing demons who put their passengers' lives and their own in danger. Partly as a consequence, Kenya has one of the highest per capita rates of traffic deaths in the world. In developing countries, road accidents now kill the same number of people as does malaria. Across the globe, nearly 1.3 million people die in traffic accidents each year, making traffic injuries the world's ninth leading cause of death. The World Health Organization projects that by 2030, they may be the fifth largest killer, ahead of HIV/AIDS, diabetes, and war and violence. Countries like Kenya call on a number of remedies for this problem. They can decrease speed limits, repair hazardous and damaged roads, encourage seatbelt use, install speed bumps, and crack down on drunk driving. Many of these measures can reduce the grisly toll, but all require public money and vigilant enforcement, both of which are in short supply. So in an ingenious and elegant field study, two Georgetown University economists, James Habyarimana and William Jack, devised an alternative method to change the behavior of Kenya's daredevil drivers and limit the nation's traffic carnage. Working with the cooperatives that own and operate the vehicles, Habyarimana and Jack recruited 2,276 matatu drivers. Then they divided everyone into two groups. Drivers with vehicles whose license plates ended in an even number became the control group. They kept operating as usual. Those with an odd final digit on their license plates took part in a unique intervention. Inside each of these matatus, researchers placed five stickers in both English and Kiswahili, Kenya's national language. Some of the stickers included only words. It said things like, "Don't just sit there as he drives dangerously. Stand up, speak up now." Or, "Hey, if he's driving recklessly, will you arrive? Be awake, be steady, speak up." Others featured text accompanied by explicit and gruesome images of severed body parts. But all urged passengers to take action, to implore their driver to slow down, to complain loudly when he attempted breakneck maneuvers, and to browbeat him until he operated the matatu more like a mild-mannered Dr. Jekyll than a maniacal Mr. Hyde. The researchers dubbed their strategy heckle and chide. Over the next year, the team found that passengers riding in matatus bearing stickers were three times as likely to heckle drivers as those in the stickerless matatus. But did the efforts of these loud-mouthed passengers move the drivers or affect the safety of their journeys? To find out, researchers examined a database of claims from the insurance companies that covered the matatus. The results were remarkable. total insurance claims for the vehicles with stickers fell by nearly two-thirds from the year before. Claims for serious accidents, those involving injury or death, fell by more than 50%. And based on follow-up interviews the researchers conducted with drivers, it was clear that the passengers' vocal persuasion efforts were the reason. In other words, adding a few stickers to the minibuses saved more money and spared more lives than just about any other effort the Kenyan government had tried. And the mechanism at work here, the stickers move the passengers and the passengers move the driver, offers a useful way to understand our third and final skill, to serve. Sales and non-sales selling are ultimately about service. But service isn't just smiling at customers when they enter your boutique or delivering a pizza in 30 minutes or less, though both are important in the commercial realm. Instead, it's a broader, deeper, and more transcendent definition of service, improving others' lives and, in turn, improving the world. At its best, moving people can achieve something greater and more enduring than merely an exchange of resources. And that's more likely to happen if we follow the two underlying lessons of the Matatu sticker triumph. Make it personal and make it purposeful. One, make it personal. Radiologists lead lonely professional lives. Unlike many physicians who spend large parts of their day interacting directly with patients, radiologists often sit alone in dimly lit rooms or hunched over computers, reading x-rays, CT scans, and MRIs. Such isolation can dull these highly skilled doctors' interest in their jobs, and worse, if the work begins to feel impersonal and mechanical, it can diminish their actual performance. A few years ago, a young Israeli radiologist named Yonathan Turner had an inkling about how to move his fellow practitioners to do their jobs with more gusto and greater skill. Working as a resident at the Shaar Zedek Medical Center in Jerusalem, Turner arranged, with patients' consent, to take photos of about 300 people coming in for a computed tomography or CT scan. Then he enlisted a group of radiologists who didn't know what he was studying for an experiment. When radiologists sat at their computers and called up one of these patients' CT scans to make an assessment, the patient's photograph automatically appeared next to the image. After they'd made their assessments, the radiologists completed a questionnaire. All of them reported feeling more empathy to the patients after seeing the photograph and being more meticulous in the way they examined the scan. But the real power of Turner's idea revealed itself 3 months later. One of the skills that separates outstanding radiologists from average ones is their ability to identify what are called incidental findings, abnormalities on a scan that the physician wasn't looking for and that aren't related to the ailment for which the patient is being treated. For example, suppose I suspect that I've broken my arm and I go to the hospital for an x-ray. The doctor's main job is to see if my ulna is fractured. But if she also spots an unrelated cyst near my elbow, that's an incidental finding. Turner selected 81 of the photo-accompanied scans in which his radiologists had found incidental findings and presented them again to the same group of radiologists 3 months later, only this time without the picture of the patient. Because radiologists read so many images each day and because they were blind to what Turner was studying, they didn't know they'd already seen these particular scans. The outcome was startling. Turner discovered that 80% of the incidental findings were not reported when the photograph was omitted from the file. Even though the physicians were looking at precisely the same image they had scrutinized 90 days earlier, this time they were far less meticulous and far less accurate. Our study emphasizes approaching the patient as a human being and not as an anonymous case study, Turner told Science Daily. Physicians, like all of us, are in the moving business. But in order for them to do their jobs well, that is, to move people from sickness and injury to health and well-being, doctors fare better when they make it personal. Instead of seeing patients as a duffel bag of symptoms, viewing them as full-fledged human beings helps physicians in their work and patients in their treatment. Now, this doesn't mean doctors and nurses should abandon checklists and protocols, but it does mean that a single-minded reliance on processes and algorithms that obscures the human being on the other side of the transaction is akin to a clinical error. As Turner's study shows, and because of his work, photographs are now being added to pap smear specimens, blood tests, and other diagnostics. Injecting the personal into the professional can boost performance and increase quality of care. And what's true for doctors is true for the rest of us. Every circumstance in which we try to move others by definition involves another human being. Yet in the name of professionalism, we often neglect the human element and adopt a stance that's abstract and distant. Instead, we should recalibrate our approach so that it's concrete and personal. And not for soft-hearted reasons, but for hard-headed ones. The general problem of road safety in Kenya is abstract and distant. Equipping individual passengers to influence their own matatu driver while he is driving them makes it concrete and personal. Reading a CT scan alone in a room is abstract and distant. Reading a CT scan when a photograph of the patient is staring back at you makes it concrete and personal. In both traditional sales and non-sales selling, we do better when we move beyond solving a puzzle to serving a person. But the value of making it personal has two sides. One is recognizing the person you're trying to serve, as in remembering the individual human being behind the CT scan. The other is putting yourself personally behind whatever it is that you're trying to sell. I've seen this flip side in action, not in the pages of a social science journal or in the corridors of a radiology lab, but on the walls of a pizzeria in Washington, D.C. One Saturday night last year, my wife and two of our three kids decided to try a new restaurant, Il Canale, an inexpensive Italian place that had been recommended by friends from Italy. We had to wait a few minutes before being seated, and since I suffer from inveterate pacing disorder, I did a few laps inside the small front lobby. But I halted when I saw a sign. Let me describe it to you. It's a framed photograph of the restaurant's owner, Giuseppe Ferrugio. And on it, he says, "I need your help. If you had anything less than a great experience at Il Canale, please call my cell." Then he listed his cell phone number. Ferrugio, who came to the United States from Sicily when he was 17, is in sales, of course. He's selling fresh antipasti, linguine alle vongole, and certified Neapolitan pizza to hungry families. But with this sign, he's transforming his offering from distant and abstract, Washington, D.C. is not short on places that serve pizza and pasta, to concrete and personal. And he's doing it in an especially audacious way. For Ferrugio, service isn't about delivering a pizza in 29 minutes. For him, service is about literally being at the call of his customers. When I talked with him a few weeks later about the response he'd gotten, Ferrugio said that in the first 18 months he posted the sign, he received a total of only 8 calls. 6 were from people offering praise, or perhaps testing if the promise was for real. 2 came from customers with complaints, which Ferrugio used to improve his service. But the importance of what he's doing isn't the calls he's receiving from customers, it's what he's communicating to them. Namely, that there's a person behind the pizza and that person cares about whether his guests are happy. Just as putting a photograph alongside the CT scan changes the way radiologists do their job, putting his own smiling face and phone number above the front cash register changes the way customers experience Ferrugio's restaurant. Many of us like to say, "I'm accountable," or "I care." Few of us are so deeply committed to serving others that we're willing to say, "Call my cell." Ferrugio's style of making it personal is characteristic of many of the most successful sellers. Brett Boll, who runs Scrubadoo.com, which sells medical scrubs, sends a handwritten note to every single customer who buys one of his products. Tammy Darvish, the car dealer we met in Chapter 3, gives her home email address to all of her customers, telling them, "If you have any questions or concerns, contact me personally." They do. And when she responds, they know she's there to serve. 2. Make it purposeful. American hospitals aren't as dangerous as Kenyan matatus, but they're far less safe than you'd think. Each year, about one out of every 20 hospitalized patients contracts an infection in a U.S. hospital, and the resulting toll is staggering. 99,000 annual deaths and a yearly cost of upward of $40 billion. The most cost-effective way to prevent these infections is for doctors, nurses, and other healthcare professionals to regularly wash their hands. But the frequency of hand-washing in U.S. hospitals is astonishingly low, and many of the efforts to get more people scrubbing their hands more often have been sadly ineffective. Adam Grant, the Wharton professor, whose research on ambiversion I discussed in Chapter 4, decided to see if he could find a better way to move those working inside hospitals to change their behavior. In research he conducted with David Hoffman of the University of North Carolina, Grant tried out three different approaches to this non-sales selling challenge. The two researchers went to a U.S. hospital and obtained permission to post signs next to 66 of the hospital's soap and hand sanitizing gel dispensers for 2 weeks. One-third of those signs appealed to the healthcare professional self-interest. Hand hygiene prevents you from catching diseases. One-third emphasized the consequences for patients, that is, the purpose of the hospital's work. Hand hygiene prevents patients from catching diseases. The final one-third of the signs included a snappy slogan and served as the control condition: gel in, wash out. The researchers weighed the bags of soap and gel at the beginning of the 2-week period and weighed them again at the end to see how much the employees actually used. And when they tabulated the results, they found that the most effective sign by far was the second one. The amount of hand hygiene product used from dispensers with a patient consequences sign was significantly greater than the amount used from dispensers with the personal consequences sign, or the control sign, Grant and Hoffman wrote. Intrigued by the results, the researchers decided to test the robustness of their findings 9 months later in different units of the same hospital. This time they used only two signs: the personal consequences version, hand hygiene prevents you from catching diseases, and the patient consequences one, hand hygiene prevents patients from catching diseases. And instead of weighing bags of soap and sanitizer, they recruited hospital personnel to be their hand-washing spies. Over a 2-week period, these recruits, who weren't told the nature of the study, covertly recorded when doctors, nurses, and other healthcare staff faced a, quote, hand hygiene opportunity, and whether those employees actually hygiene their hands when such an opportunity arose. Once again, the personal consequences sign had zero effect. But the sign appealing to purpose boosted hand washing by 10% overall and significantly more for the physicians. Clever signs alone won't eliminate hospital-acquired infections. As surgeon Atul Gawande has observed, checklists and other processes can be highly effective on this front. But Grant and Hoffman reveal something equally crucial. Our findings suggest that health and safety messages should focus not on the self, but rather on the target group that is perceived as most vulnerable. Raising the salience of purpose is one of the most potent and most overlooked methods of moving others. While we often assume that human beings are motivated mainly by self-interest, a stack of research has shown that all of us also do things for what social scientists call pro-social or self-transcending reasons. That means that not only should we ourselves be serving, but we should also be tapping others' innate desire to serve. Making it personal works better when we also make it purposeful. To take just one example from the research, a team of British and New Zealand scholars recently conducted a pair of clever experiments in another non-sales selling context. They randomly assigned their participants to three groups. One group read information about why car sharing is good for the environment. Researchers dubbed these folks the self-transcending group. One read about why car sharing can save people money. This was the self-interested group. The third, the control group, read general information about car travel. Then the participants filled out a few unrelated questionnaires to occupy their time. When they were done, They were dismissed and told to discard any remaining papers they still had. And to do that, they had two choices: a clearly marked bin for regular waste and a clearly marked bin for recycling. About half the people in the second and third groups, these self-interested and control groups, recycled their papers. But in the self-transcending first group, nearly 90% chose to recycle. Merely discussing purpose in one realm, car sharing, moved people to behave differently in a second realm, recycling. What's more, Grant's research has shown that purpose is a performance enhancer not only in efforts like the promotion of hand washing and recycling, but also in traditional sales. In 2008, he carried out a fascinating study of a call center at a major U.S. university. Each night, employees made phone calls to alumni to raise money for the school. As is the habit of social psychologists, Grant randomly organized the fundraisers into three groups. Then he arranged their work conditions to be identical, except for the 5 minutes prior to their shift. For two consecutive nights, one group read stories from people who'd previously worked in the call center, explaining that the job had taught them useful sales skills, perhaps attunement, buoyancy, and clarity. This was the personal benefit group. Another, the purpose group, read stories from university alumni who'd received scholarships funded by the money this call center had raised, describing how those scholarships had helped them. The third collection of callers was the control group, who read stories that had nothing to do with either personal benefit or purpose. After the reading exercise, the workers hit the phones, admonished not to mention the stories they just read to the people they were trying to move to donate money. A few weeks later, Grant looked at their sales numbers. The personal benefit and control groups secured about the same number of pledges and raised the same amount of money as they had in the period before the story reading exercise. But the people in the purpose group kicked into overdrive. They more than doubled the number of weekly pledges that they earned and the amount of weekly donation money that they raised. Sales trainers, take note. This 5-minute reading exercise more than doubled production. The stories made the work personal, their contents made it purposeful. This is what it means to serve, improving another's life, and in turn, improving the world. That's the lifeblood of service and the final secret to moving others. In 1970, an obscure 66-year-old former mid-level AT&T executive named Robert Greenleaf wrote an essay that launched a movement. He titled it Servant as Leader, and in a few dozen earnest pages, he turned the reigning philosophies of business and political leadership upside down. Greenleaf argued that the most effective leaders weren't heroic take-charge commanders, but instead were quieter, humbler types whose animating purpose was to serve those nominally beneath them. Greenleaf called his notion servant leadership and explained that the order of those two words held the key to its meaning. The servant leader is servant first, he wrote. Becoming a servant leader begins with a natural feeling that one wants to serve first. Then conscious choice brings one to aspire to lead. The very idea of leaders subordinating themselves to followers, of inverting the traditional pyramid, discomfited many people. But Greenleaf's philosophy excited many more. Those who embraced it learned to do no harm, to respond to any problem by listening first, and to accept and empathize rather than reject. Over time, companies as diverse as Starbucks, TD Industries, Southwest Airlines, and Brooks Brothers integrated Greenleaf's ideas into their management practices. Business schools added Greenleaf to their reading lists and syllabi. Nonprofit organizations and religious institutions introduced his principles to their members. What helped servant leadership take hold wasn't merely that many of those who tried it found it effective. It was also that the approach gave voice to their latent beliefs about other people and their deeper aspirations for themselves. Greenleaf's way of leading was more difficult, but it was also more transformative. As he wrote, "The best test and the most difficult to administer is this. Do those served grow as persons? Do they, while being served, become healthier, wiser, freer, more autonomous, more likely themselves to become servants? The time is ripe for the sales version of Greenleaf's philosophy. Call it servant selling. It begins with the idea that those who move others aren't manipulators, but are servants. They serve first and sell later. And the test, which, like Greenleaf's, is the best and the most difficult to administer, is this. If the person you're selling to agrees to buy, will his or her life improve? When your interaction is over, will the world be a better place than when you began? Servant selling is the essence of moving others today. But in some sense, it has always been present in those who've granted sales its proper respect. For instance, Alfred Fuller, the man whose company gave Norman Hall his unlikely vocation, said that at a critical point in his own career, he realized that his work was better, in all senses of the word, when he served first and sold next. He began thinking of himself as a civic reformer, a benefactor to families, and, as he put it, a crusader against unsanitary kitchens and inadequately cleaned homes. It seemed a bit silly, he admitted, but the successful seller must feel some commitment that his product offers mankind as much altruistic benefit as it yields the seller in money. An effective seller isn't a huckster who is just out for profit, he said. The true salesman is an idealist and an artist. So too is the true person. Among the things that distinguish our species from others is our combination of idealism and artistry, our desire both to improve the world and to provide that world with something it didn't know it was missing. Moving others doesn't require that we neglect these nobler aspects of our nature. Today, it demands that we embrace them. It begins and ends by remembering that to sell is human. Here's the sample case for Chapter 9, Serve. First, move from upselling to upserving. One of the most detestable words in the lexicon of sales is upselling. You go to the sporting goods store for basic running shoes, and the salesperson tries to get you to buy the priciest pair on the shelf. You purchase a camera, and the guy behind the counter presses you to buy a kit that's no good, accessories you don't want, and an extended warranty you don't need. Once, when ordering something online, before I was able to check out, the site pelted me with about a half dozen add-ons in which I had no interest, and when I looked at the web address, it read www.nameofthecompany.com/upsell. I quit the transaction there and never bought anything from that operation again. Sadly, many traditional sales training programs still teach people to upsell. But if they were smarter, they'd banish both the concept and the word and replace it with a far friendlier and demonstrably more effective alternative. Upserve. Upserve means doing more for the other person than he expects or you initially intended, taking the extra steps that transform a mundane interaction into a memorable experience. This simple move, from upselling to upserving, has the obvious advantage of being the right thing to do. But it also carries the hidden advantage of being extraordinarily effective. Anytime you're tempted to upsell someone else, stop what you're doing and upserve instead. Don't try to increase what they can do for you. Elevate what you can do for them. Second, rethink sales commissions. Even after listening to this book, you might still believe that traditional salespeople just aren't like the rest of us. You and I have a mix of motives, many of them high-minded, but not those folks who sell household appliances or home security systems. They're different. They are, and here's an adjective I hear a lot, coin-operated. Slip a quarter into their slot and they'll do a little dance. When the time runs out, insert another coin, or they'll stop dancing. That's why we rely on sales commissions to motivate and compensate many people in traditional sales. It's the best, perhaps the only, way to get them to move. But what if we're wrong? What if we offer commissions largely because, well, we've always offered commissions? What if the practice has so cemented into orthodoxy that it ceased being an actual decision? And what if it actually stands in the way of the ability to serve? That's what Microchip Technology, a $6.5 billion American semiconductor